Hi, everybody. Welcome to KLCC's Northwest Passage, our weekly podcast. I'm Rachel McDonald, KLCC News Director.
And I'm news reporter Brian Bull.
I'm Mallory Begay, the Diversity Fellow.
And I'm Ani Katz, host of Morning Edition.
Well, coming up, we'll be talking a little bit about some of the stories Mallory and Brian have been covering this week. But first, Ani, what news stories were you paying attention to this week?
So I think we'll start with the earlier stories and then work our way towards the later part of the week. After nearly a week of delay, a bill to inject $1 billion per year more into Oregon's K-12 schools is on its way to Governor Kate Brown. It's just waiting for her signature now. House Bill 3427, a new tax on large Oregon businesses, passed the state Senate along party lines on Monday. While this means that Democrats have accomplished their signature goal of this year's legislative session, it also meant some major compromises. Republicans essentially boycotted the process. They didn't show up for 4 days, and you do need at least two Republicans to have a quorum to put it to vote. So they didn't show up for 4 days. Democrats ended up having to press pause on a couple of bills that would have tightened gun control and vaccine laws. The issue for Republicans, the reason why they weren't showing up, is that they feel that lawmakers need to address a ballooning debt in the state pension system, which we know as PERS. So while this education funding bill was passed, and it is indeed a monumental amount of money to go to Oregon schools, I was a student in Oregon schools in 1990 when that initial kind of defunding happened. There's obviously a lot that both parties still hope to accomplish. And speaking of money, Oregon took in historic amounts of revenue this year, mostly due to tax changes on the federal level. So the state's May economic forecast was delivered on Wednesday and predicted that Oregon will take in $900 million more than what was predicted just 3 months ago, which is a huge difference.
The tax filing season was crazy in the last couple months since we last met with this group. Both our corporate and our personal income tax collections are up more than 50%.
State economist Mark McMullen says this is actually a seismic event, and due to a unique law to Oregon, some of that revenue actually goes back to the taxpayer. This is called a kicker law. It refunds tax collections above initial estimates. This is a little tricky, so pay attention. If those collections come in 2% or more above what was anticipated. So Oregon currently expects to collect way more than that, 7.6% over initial forecasts, meaning that an anticipated kicker refund of more than $1.4 billion, the largest dollar amount in state history. So that the median rebate is going to be about $340 per person, obviously way more if you're in a higher tax bracket. McMullen, the state economist, did say that these numbers are bittersweet. In other states, record revenues get to go back into state coffers. In Oregon, they go back to the taxpayer.
Huh. Oh, that's a seismic event some can get behind.
Yeah, exactly. And then moving on to an issue that we have talked about in previous podcasts, even though it is just May and it's raining outside, we did have a very hot week last week. And so we're seeing both fires and algal blooms. They're both way earlier this year, and it's making it feel a lot more like it's already summer.
Yeah, we had that really hot week last week when temperatures got up into the 80s and there was a fire east of Cottage Grove, a brush fire in a logging area that did burn one structure. And there was a level one evacuation notice, which is be ready to leave, that was issued by the Lane County Sheriff that afternoon. So, yeah, it means fire season has come early.
And it's been a rough couple of months for the residents of Cottage Grove, because before that there was flood warnings and people had to evacuate their homes and there was a Red Cross shelter set up. So we go from floods to fires all within a few weeks.
And I should also add that the height of fire season is still months away. So even though it is just mid-May, the fact that we're already seeing it is, I think it means we're going to be in for a long summer, a smoky summer.
When I spoke with a spokesman for Oregon Department of Forestry, Marcus Kaufman, he did mention that it's still quite early in fire season. The height of fire season is usually August, September in our region.
What I've been saying is that it feels like summer, even though we're still in spring. And it's just we hope it's not a harbinger of things to come, and we hope the rains will forestall the true start to fire season. But things are very dry.
Mallory, you had a busy week this week. We heard your report on virtual reality classrooms on Monday, and then you've covered quite a few really interesting stories. The latest, which was the city of Eugene released its report on hate and bias crimes. What kind of stood out for you in this report?
So yeah, according to the city of Eugene's annual report, hate and bias incidents are down 42%, and 2018 saw 81 incidents compared to 139 the year before. So the report is done by the city of Eugene. It's been around for 7 years. So there's not a ton of data, and so they're a little, and they recognize this in the report, is that the lack of data, it's hard to figure out different trends. So the decrease in 42% from 2017 to 2018, that's a steep decline, but it's hard to say definitively why that is. Most likely it's because 2017 was the year following a contentious presidential election. And so nationally, hate and bias incidences rose. And so that's one possibility. Another possibility is the response from police departments and the city in general. But there's still also concern about underreporting. I think there's a national survey that says that 20 to 40% of all reporting of hate and bias incidents is underreported.
I remember the 2016 presidential campaign was extremely polarizing. You had a lot of rhetoric against Muslims, against immigrants, a lot of talk about building the wall. And there was also a lot of critics who looked at the president, Trump, then President Trump's delayed response to the violence in Charlottesville, that for many people thought was a thumbs up or a proceed kind of a statement for many nationalist, alt-right, white supremacist groups to go ahead and ratchet up their rhetoric and their activity. And I know that groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center have been tracking a lot of this activity. So it seems very plausible that an increase in hate crimes and bias had increased somewhat in that first year following the election. And it also makes me wonder what we may see in the year ahead, because technically we are on the brink of yet another campaign season where the president, who banked on a lot of that rhetoric, may rely on some of those voters again in those blocks. And what you said, too, about policing, I know that there is some suspicion in the Latino Hispanic community that those who may be the target of hate crimes may be very hesitant to approach the police because they fear that could lead to deportation. So I remember talking to Pete Kearns before he retired. He said that was not the aim of the Eugene Police Department to target people for deportation or reporting to ICE, that they wanted people to still work with them. But for many in that community, it's still, I think the consequences of just having that trust or that outreach breached is very daunting. And so I think that may be feeding the underreporting as well.
And you just mentioned Pete Kearns. He's the former Eugene police chief. And Mallory, you also covered a story this week with the current Eugene police chief, Chris Skinner, and he was doing some construction, correct?
Yeah. So Chris Skinner or Chief Skinner and a few police officers and members of the Eugene Springfield Fire Department with different community organizations to build these small, tiny, they're called Conestoga huts, and they're like these small,
tiny houses.
Tiny
basically.
Houses, yeah. And so, like, there's enough room for a bed, and it's for homeless people as they're transitioning to find more permanent homes. And so, the thing that it does is that it helps them basically have an address so that they can apply for jobs and they can have access to other services that they wouldn't normally have. So the Eugene Police Department decided that this would be a good idea, and because it's a part of what Chris Skinner called 21st century policing, in that trying to focus on service aspect of law enforcement. Mm-hmm.
And that's what this community needs from a police department, is finding ways not to have to respond to the same thing over and over again. And that's what we're doing here. This is exactly what this looks like.
In his eyes, The police department doesn't have a lot of resources in order to go to every single call. So it's important that the calls that they do respond to are actual emergency calls, where rather than calls involving homeless populations.
Right. So. Yeah. Thanks for sharing some of your reporting this week. Brian, tell us a little bit about what you've been working on.
In short, a story that I put on this week was a little bit of follow-up to last week's podcast, where we had mentioned that the New York Times had an analysis of available tax documentation showing that then investor Trump had lost over $1 billion in a decade, a bigly amount by any stretch. No president before has ever not disclosed their tax returns, as long as tax returns have been a thing anyway. But Oregon Democratic Congressman Peter DeFazio still wants those returns. He joins a chorus of Democrats who feel that this is a credibility issue, an integrity issue. And here he is explaining a little bit more in his own words.
A lot of his grand success obviously is a myth. He's a huckster, salesman, grifter, whatever you want to call him. We need his federal returns, because the critical thing is not what a bad businessman he was. The critical thing is who bailed him out and who is he beholden to.
Where Congressman DeFazio is coming from is that he figures someone had to bail Donald Trump out after that significant loss in the 80s. Perhaps Deutsche Bank, which now President Trump is suing, I understand, to keep from disclosing its financial records. DeFazio says a full disclosure of Trump's business dealings would ensure that no Russian money was channeled through, thereby compromising the country's highest elected official. One thing that we also did this week was the community conversation that we've mentioned and advertised quite a bit here on KLZC leading up to the event. We had four panelists from across Oregon's indigenous communities. We had Sarah Thompson, spokesperson for the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, Robert Kenta, treasurer and cultural resources director for the Confederated Tribes of the Tsleil-Waututh Indians, Leilani Subsalian, assistant professor of indigenous studies at the University of Oregon, and Brenda Brainerd, program director of the Eugene 4J District's Natives Programs, which my children go to for disclosure's sake. This was the culmination of a year-long project examining Native American issues across Oregon. We had a monthly feature series co-produced with KLCC's Karen Richards that tried to throw either fresher, in-depth perspectives on familiar topics like education and history, or reveal lesser-known aspects like the Two-Spirit community, which redefines sexuality and orientation beyond the Western concept, and also things like how sustainability practices have inspired others who look at the tribes and how they manage their forests. What I learned from last night's discussion was that our series helped set the stage for a much larger discussion about identity, resilience, and a sense of belonging for Indigenous people in their communities here in Oregon.
And that series was funded by the University of Oregon Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics. And at the community conversation, I feel like we really got a deeper understanding of the issues that Native Americans face. And it was pretty powerful, some of the stories that we heard from the panelists.
Yeah, I think one thing that I learned from last night's discussion was that our series helped set the stage for a much larger discussion about identity, resilience, and a sense of belonging for Indigenous people and their communities here in Oregon. Here's Leilani Subsalian talking about the challenges facing tribal leadership immersed in a dominant Western mindset.
Indigenous people have been raised in the same racist, sexist, homophobic society that most people are raised in. And so sometimes Native leaders can reproduce some of the systems of oppression that harm tribal members.
Altogether, we had about 60 people fill out the LCC Longhouse. And we have two more features in the series. The one that I'm working on for May is about Indigenous foods. And I believe that Karen Richards is working on one that utilizes storytelling to some degree.
And we're looking forward to hearing those. And a reminder to folks listening to this podcast, you can find all of those stories at our website, klcc.org. Well, now it's time for us to wrap up this week's podcast by talking about a story from this week's news that is sticking with you or that you just feel like has been on your mind. So let's start with Let's start with Ani.
So it's an unusual thing to crave eggplant parmesan at 4:45 in the morning, but I'm going to fully admit to doing that this week because they had the editor of Sever Magazine, Stacey Adamondo, who just wrote a cookbook book about her heritage and also has recipes from Italy, mostly centering, I think, on little plates. And so she and David Green had a very nice tasty sounding conversation for about 10 minutes on Morning Edition earlier this week, where she talked about regional specialties, mostly from where her family's from in Italy, which I think is Calabria, which is in the south. But then one of the dishes she mentioned was a northern Italian dish, which has some sort of a local fresh cheese and celery, which is actually one of the only foods I don't eat. But this made it sound good because it had a lot of local olive oil and fresh mountain herbs like sage and rosemary. And it just totally made my mouth water at like 5 a.m., which, wow. You know, you should be craving like scrambled eggs or really nothing at that hour. But I urge you to listen to it and maybe even check out some of those recipes online.
That celery recipe sounds fantastic.
I know. And I don't even like celery.
Puts ants on a log to shame.
Definitely.
And I think eggplant parmesan is a perfect breakfast, actually.
I might ask you to make me some, actually. She said that people associate it in the States as like a, you know, huge meal you'd get at like a red sauce Italian joint. But that traditionally, at least where what her family does is they put it out as a small plate, mm-hmm. and they cut it up into tiny, tiny pieces. And so you get just these bites of eggplant parm, which again had me very hungry at about 5 a.m.
So I was a PBS kid, which means I watched a lot of PBS shows. And so this week on Arthur, Mr. Ratburn, the teacher in the children's TV show, married his partner. And so that was really exciting just because, I mean, it brought back memories of watching Arthur as a child. And two, it's just interesting to see how far society has changed and like how much more LGBTQ representation there is, even in, I think it's pretty significant that it's even in, like, a children's show. So I was pretty excited about
that. If Patty's his sister, then who is Mr. Ratburn marrying?
And I will say, even though I'm not with my kids in the morning, I loved hearing the Arthur theme song during Morning Edition. So that was really a treat to have them talk about that. And congratulations, Mr. Ratburn.
Yeah. Way to go, Mr. Ratburn. On my end, nationally, what stuck out for me is that we are now looking at a field of Democratic presidential candidates, now at 23. We've had in this week alone Montana Governor Steve Bullock and New York Mayor Bill de Blasio both jumping in. This is all going to have to come crashing down and resolving itself by the 2020 Democratic Convention in Milwaukee, I believe in July next year. So that's where we're going to see this crowd, I'm sure, in the next year parsed down, and a lot of people stumping in New Hampshire and Iowa, of course, and elsewhere. One last little tidbit about that is that the Democratic Convention is going to be held in Wisconsin, which is a battleground state that I believe Hillary Clinton lost to Trump. And so the Democrats, I think, are also trying to send a message that we're not neglecting the heart of America, the mid-American communities, as some critics feared that they did during the last contest. And then I continue to keep an eye on the local Cherokee uprising. This Tuesday morning, we had about 350 people in southeastern Eugene find themselves without power. And investigators with eWeb found that a lone Cherokee, a saboteur, hit a feeder line and caused the outage, sacrificing itself for the cause. The blackout, or the outage, I should say, lasted under 90 minutes. One particular takeaway from this that eWeb wants to share with our listeners is that residents should not feed turkeys if you find them in a developed area down your street. Don't throw out seed. Don't throw out anything. Turkeys are apparently second only to squirrels when it comes to causing disruptions like this. I did a story back in 2016 about turkeys in Medford causing at least 4 outages in that area. And many can't be hunted if they're too close to city limits. So again, from eWeb and from Fish and Wildlife officials, don't feed the turkeys. They're going to get too comfortable and they're going to acclimate and they're going to settle in your neighborhood if you're not careful.
I think we have forever to thank Councillor Greg Evans for his calling them gangster turkeys, which is what I think of every single time I see them, because they are gangster turkeys.
That was Eugene City Councilor Greg Evans.
Right.
And they're starting to intrude. I've seen photos in the Register Guard about them trying to get into hotels and banks in downtown Eugene. So, yeah, they're organized. Be very wary. But to the turkey in question, this one did not survive the encounter with the power line. Maybe it was just all for the cause. Maybe it was sacrificing itself for William Shatner's dinner.
I want a deep-fried turkey.
Shatner is coming to the Holt Center Sunday night for a special screening of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. There's your reminder. I'll be moderating the conversation, and I hope to see many of our Trekkie listeners there.
And again, that's Sunday, May 19th at the Holt Center in Eugene.
I just want to know, are you going to have like Klingon ears, or like what do you wear? What are we doing here?
I thought about wearing one of my Starfleet uniforms, but I don't know. I'm told that wearing red especially is not safe when you're in the vicinity of Mr. Shatner. So I want to survive the encounter.
So I wanted to mention Doris Day passed away earlier this week at the age of 97, and I was really pleased to listen back to the Fresh Air interview with her. It originally aired in 2012 when Doris Day was 88. She was just about to turn 88 years old. And it's a unique interview in that it's one of the only ones I've ever heard over the phone. So Doris Day was willing to be interviewed by Terry Gross, but not to go into a studio and not to, you know, have somebody come and record in person. So it was over phone tape, which I think is remarkable. But Doris Day was so gracious, and you just really get a sense of her personality. And it's so interesting because she retired from Hollywood in the 1970s, moved to Carmel Valley, which is where I grew up. And she became this, you know, caretaker of dogs, and that was her passion for her life. And she talked about the number of dogs. Like at one point, she had 30 dogs in her house.
Wow.
My wildest dream.
That's amazing. And she just has, you know, she's had an interesting life. She was actually, what Terry Gross said was that Doris Day was the top female box office star in Hollywood history. And that's pretty remarkable.
I also thought it was remarkable, too, that she kind of walked away at the pinnacle of her career. And in the obit that I heard on NPR, too, she also requested no services, no funeral. It was just like she just kind of walked away from it all. And maybe she was content doing that.
Yeah, it was interesting because Terry asked her, you know, why didn't you still continue to do movies even though you were living, you know, in Carmel Valley instead of in Hollywood? And she just said she was just done. So pretty remarkable.
And an amazing personality, too.
So I think that wraps up this week's episode of KLCC's Northwest Passage. I'm news director Rachel McDonald.
I'm news reporter Brian Bull.
Morning Edition host Ani Katz.
Diversity fellow Mallory Begay.
Thanks so much.
You won't admit you love me, and so how am I ever to know? You always tell me, perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. A million times I've asked you, and then I ask you over again. You only answer, perhaps, perhaps, perhaps.